the Hacksaw Laser Show. It is episode number 5 tonight, and it is Saturday, the 24th of April. So, just to let you know, tonight we got Captain Crunch on for our 5th episode. We were instructed by Captain Crunch, John Draper, not to talk about anything off the topic of the Crunch Box and the white paper. So, just to let you guys know, we wanted to talk about Freaking, but he wouldn't let us. So, he just really wanted to plug and promote his Crunch Box. So, we hope you enjoyed this episode, even though there's not going to be any Freaking talk or related things. Hopefully, we can get him back on and cover that topic in the future. But I think you'll find this episode pretty interesting. We all did.
Yeah.
Hey, John.
So what do you think of the article? Did you read it?
Yeah, I read it.
What do you think?
I think it's a bit vague on what you're trying to... It's a little vague on what you're trying to achieve, I think.
Vague? How so?
Well, it basically specifies, like, outlines for creating such a system, and, I don't know, it just...
I would like to know what the Crunch Box itself does. The white paper goes into detail about what you need what you need on the machine, what kind of machine you need. Do you need VMware? You need other utilities. But what is the Crunch Box itself? What is that doing as far as analyzing?
The Crunch Box is what you would call a network analysis tool. It basically sits on the network. It can either be in a passive mode, watching over a very large bank of IP addresses, or it can even act as a router with itself. In other words, it could actually become a router. However, on network-wise, for the largest scale detection, having it in a passive bridge mode means that you don't change the architecture of the network that it detects. There's no critical component that can fail, per se. In other words, if there's any problem or if there's any failure, it wouldn't be the Crunch Box, because it would just sit on the network and look for hostile activity. When it finds hostile activity defined by a set of snort IDS rules, it then has enough intelligence to deal with the situation in real time as it happens. An example of this would be, as I mentioned in the white paper, I talked about the possibility of, let's say, a virus. If an already infected system is brought into a network that is allegedly a clean network, and if that virus tries to make some type of a TCP connection, as viruses mostly do, it's stopped immediately.
I was wondering how you disinfect the virus. Do you have an antivirus software?
If the virus itself is brought or moved from one node to another node inside a network protected by Crunch Box, yes, it can detect it, and yes, it will stop it. However, what happens if a person takes a machine that is infected already, that got infected because it was outside the network, and brings it inside the network? What's going to happen then? See, because the virus itself already exists on the machine, it got connected to the network, the byte pattern of that virus never transmitted over the network. So therefore, the network doesn't even know that that machine is infected. However, that machine could conceivably spread its infection to other machines. See, so it's a problem of, it's already infected. It's a bad apple thrown in the bunch of apples that's going to infect all the rest. So how do you deal with that?
Well, obviously you would have to either have a security policy in your company that would absolutely strictly forbid any foreign systems to be brought into your network, which some companies actually do, or you can take a more lenient approach and just be looking for the virus's protocol. So not only do we have a signature for the detection of the virus being transmitted itself into and out of the network, but we also can detect the protocol used by the virus.
How does
when the virus makes an attempt at phone home after the initial infection, or in the case of a Trojan being controlled by a spam bot, say, okay, start spamming. See, well, that protocol has to go over the internet. It's got to go over the TCP path. And because it can go over the path, it can be detected.
So how does this differ from other intrusion detection systems?
It's using an existing intrusion detection system already. We've made absolutely no changes to Snort whatsoever. We're using Snort. It's nothing more than you being able to write a Snort rule that works. And that's basically the key. You've got to write a rule that would detect the protocol used by the virus.
Initially, how does it determine which protocol is legit and which is like a Trojan horse?
We do that with HoneyNet. What we do is we deliberately infect the HoneyNet. We take a Windows box, a fresh version copy of a Windows box, and we deliberately infect it. We sniff the network, and we let the virus itself tell us how it works. So all we do is just watch the protocol. We don't care what it communicates. We just assume that it's going to be encrypted anyway.
Does the protocol go into a database, or does this happen in real time?
Well, what happens, first of all, is once it's detected, Once the honeypot detects the virus, it's captured. Okay? It's captured and examined just by hand. Examined. The protocol is examined at that point. And we look at the things like the TCP flags. We look at the exchange and the protocol happening. We decide whether it's a UDP or a TCP/IP or an ICMP type protocol. Because some of these viruses are pretty sophisticated. They use this thing called the knock-knock principle. The way that works is the infected host, instead of having a listener listening on a port which could respond to port scans, what they do is they have another system set on there which is not even a listener. All it does is respond to a certain sequence of ping transmissions, and usually what happens is these ping transmissions include a port, and the sequence of ports is like code, and that will then wake up the Trojan. Now the Trojan's real listener comes online, might wake up a program like WinProxy or something, and which would then, you know, be the back door into the system. Well, that protocol, of course, can also be detected. You just have to remember to include the state flags on the packet when you're looking for it, because when it comes back, you have to tell. You know, so it's just a matter of understanding how the network works and how to write the rules to do that. But you simply take the sniffed output, which you save to a disk file, and you just go through and manually scan it. It's pretty easy to find.
Okay, so basically I'm sorry, I interrupted. You can go ahead.
Okay, once you've established the protocol,
then all you need to do then is just simply emulate that protocol, because you're actually communicating with a virus at that point. You can verify that that communication works, and you can test the rule by letting the virus test the rule for you. So now you've got a unique pattern that can now be detected. So now you go ahead and you apply this snort rule that you've just made that came from your honey net, which is totally separate network than your real production network, of course. And then you put that rule into the crunch box of the network that you're protecting. Now what happens is if that virus tries to make a communication. You there?
Yes.
Okay. If a virus then tries to communicate, either because the spam bot tried to connect to the virus, or because the virus phoned home, so to speak, which some of them do, some viruses get woke up with a knock-knock. Well, that can also be detected. The minute the thing detects a knock-knock, bingo, all the ports are blocked. And the infected user is none the wiser. All of a sudden, he'll just notice a significant increase in speed, because all of a sudden now his computer system is no longer, the packets are no longer even getting into the user's computer because the firewall is blocking it. So port number 31526 is blocked now from this person's infected host. And he's not using that port. That port's blocked. The only thing that's using that port is a virus on his machine, which is now totally deactivated. At that point, the ISP would also be alerted because the detection, the NIDS, event would, of course, be logged and can be sent to the ISP. Again, that's a function of the crunch box.
Is it an automated process?
Well, you can have it sent to your cell phone as an SMS message if you want, or you can have it sent to a pager, or you could have it sent to wherever you want to send. It would usually go to the incident response center of an ISP. These people that are manned 24 hours a day that deal with incident responses. So that would be where that message would go. So once that infection takes place, the incident response center would immediately get an indication of that event. But even before the response center does anything about it, that particular virus at that point is the same. We've actually tested this on a small scale and got it working. We'd like to be able to test this on a larger scale, like a large-scale ISP.
How does this differ from a firewall that you can set permissions on, say, you can allow your web browser access to the Internet?
Well, it actually is a firewall. It's just a firewall that's dynamically controlled on the fly. It's using the same firewall commands as a regular firewall. The only difference is this particular firewall command to disable this virus is directed only to a single IP address. It's the IP address of the actually infected host and also directed to a port. As you know, in firewalls, you can block off certain ports and certain IP addresses. If a packet is going into this IP address, block it. If a packet is going into this IP address with this port number, block it. But see what I mean? So packets going into this IP address for port 80 will still let the user of that machine surf the web, or it'll still allow port 110 so the user can go in there and use and check his mail, et cetera, et cetera. But port number 31562, or whatever, port number that's used by the virus, that is being blocked, and only that's being blocked. So therefore, the virus has been disabled. It can do no damage other than just sit on that computer, but it won't affect anything else.
So even if the virus is sharing...
The whole purpose is to basically disable these viruses with... which would then cut out a lot of the resources that spammers are using to send people spam mail. Every single spam mail you get, I would say a good major portion of it, and I'm talking at least 67%, comes from infected hosts. So that penis enlargement ad you get in your mail came from some innocent person's machine. And how do they find your email address? Two ways they can find your email address. They can farm it. Or, when the virus infects your computer, if your email address happens to be in someone else's address list that you know, or he knows you, and he has your email address in his address list, then the spam you get would kind of be coming from your friend. And you don't really know that. He doesn't even know that.
What happens to the virus?
If you take a look at the first received line of a mail header, you'll very easily be able to identify that it could be coming in from HTTPI.com, Earthlink, AOL, whatever. But these are not really being mailed through AOL or Earthlink. They're coming from infected machines. They're not coming from the mail servers. You're not getting the mail from, let's say, mail.aol.com. You're getting it from an AOL DSL user. You're getting it from a cable modem user. Some Yoko person, some clueless person who goes down to Gateway Computer System, buys a gateway, goes to Comcast, gets their cable modem set up, hooks the computer up to the cable modem, and starts surfing the web. And using Eudora, not Eudora, but using Outlook, and opening up attachments just because they think it might be some porn picture or something that, you know, just because they get an attachment from an email from one of their friends, which really the mail was just masquerading as one of your friends. So if a person says, if I'm getting a mail message from my friend in the Netherlands, and here, read this attachment, I'm probably going to open that up and read it because I know it's from a friend of mine. But it really isn't coming from a friend of mine, it's coming from somewhere else. The headers are forged. You know, I mean, this is the tricks that they use to get you to open up these attachments. I mean, but then again, there's other ways that these things are spread, too. For instance, you can forget to patch your system, and there's an exploit. There's this one recently, as I remember. Then, of course, you can also receive files from AIM users. You can get on AIM and open up a file that somebody sent you and not know what it does and get infected. There's so many ways you can get infected. I mean, and these people are just using every social engineering trick in the book to do it.
I'm going back to the...
I'm sure you're smart enough not to do it.
Hopefully. I just had a question of going back to the ports and the protocols. Let's say a Trojan horse was using port 80 to communicate with the client on the other end. Would the detection system just exclude that protocol from port 80, and would you still be able to use port 80 at the same time?
You could still use port 80 at the same time. The reason why, okay, is because that port 80 transmission is going to be some unique protocol. In other words, I mean, normally if you do a protocol port 80 to say get an HTTP://whatever the HTTP protocol is, right? Well, I mean, sure, they can use that get whatever too, right? But if that protocol has anything else unique to that virus, like a specific URL, then that would uniquely identify it as coming from the virus. The same thing with using an IRC bot. I mean, most of these bots are going to be coming from port 6667.
How are you distinguishing between random browsing and virus?
Because you can distinguish it from the URL. because once you've extracted that HTTP URL from the virus, that virus will have embedded in itself its own URL because it's going to be connecting to something. Well, that's going to be unique to that virus.
So,
I mean, that virus is not going to go out there and connect it to Yahoo or to eBay. That virus is going to connect to some host that is unique to that virus.
What happens if it's a backdoor program like sub7 or back orifice where you can specify the IP address? Then how would it find which host it wants to connect to?
Well, you can't change your IP address. I mean, well, you can obviously spoof it.
Right, but what I meant was anybody can download a Trojan and put a specific host for it to connect to in that. Now, let's say there's 100 of these Trojans that are connecting to 100 different people. How do you identify each of those Trojans?
Well, it would depend on the protocol connected. For instance, each of the Trojans, it doesn't matter where they're coming from. It matters where they're going to. And it matters what port number they're going into. Because remember, you're going the other way. I mean, port 80 means you're going to go out on port 80 looking for a web page. But when the web server connects to you on your machine, the web server won't be connecting to your machine through port 80. It's going to go pick up some random port that's way up high. So, but that's an inbound connection. That's an outbound connection going from your machine outward. It's those protocols that we usually test because these are unique protocols. Because usually a virus will very often connect to secret hosts and it'll always be the same. So if I go out there and grab a virus with a honeypot and it points to some IP address that's 212.194.whatever, right, then I get another virus, and it also connects to that same secret host, as most of them do. Then all I have to really look for is that same secret host and a port number that's non-standard, and I can track on that with using Tor.
Now, would your firm provide the firewall rules to your clients?
We supply them with a complete set of all of the latest viruses and Trojans, and we're no more than a day behind. So if a virus gets released, like just day before yesterday, I grabbed about 5 viruses, and I compared the rule sets with the 5 viruses that I've had in the database, and I've noticed that 3 of them are new. So I just simply added these 3 viruses to my list. So now these 3 viruses are now, if any of our users get these 3 viruses, they're going to be protected.
How do you update the rule sets on your clients' machines? Do you have access?
We just update our server.
And it's up to the client to then download your current rule set.
They get the rules from our server whenever they, depending on how often they have it set up to do that. So all we do is maintain the rule sets on our server, and our users or customers, then we'll just, these will eventually propagate down to the servers as they connect to our server. We just serve them over the website in a tar.cz file.
Okay.
They just simply pull them down, and all these viruses get put into it. All of the ones that we send them all get put into a directory. So it doesn't wipe out anything our customers do. They've got a local set of viruses. A local set of spell rules that they have specific to themselves. So we can change our rule set. We will not affect any of the rule sets that our clients have written by themselves.
So the ones that we get, we always keep those updated. Our customers have those as updated as well, but our customers also have the freedom of writing their own rules, but if they do, our rule update will not affect theirs.
What happens if the Trojan blocks your host from downloading the newest update to the computer that's infected?
What's that?
What if the Trojan was to block your host from downloading the update to the client? Is there an alternate method for transferring the data file, the database back to the client so they can remove the Trojan?
In other words, what if the Trojan blocks... In other words, what if the... You're talking about the infected host?
Yes, what if it blocks you from downloading an update to this user?
Well, for one thing... For one thing, they'd never get access to the crutch box to be able to do anything to it. Because remember, that they're downloading the rules from the Shop IP server.
Okay.
And those rules, when they download those rules, they're going to establish a secure connection to our server to do that. There's no way that they would have to compromise our server in order to do that.
So the update's actually hard-coded into the software or something like that?
No, oh no, no. They control over when they do their upgrade. When they do, what we do is we notify them when there's an upgrade, and all they have to do is log into the crunch box and just simply type in upgrade, and that's it. The upgrades
okay.
are just handled automatically.
So the crunch box would sit outside the... infected machine and therefore not allow blocking of your host?
No, the crunch box is a separate machine. It's totally separate from all the other machines.
I believe the question he meant to ask was that the crunch box acts as a router and therefore would be impossible for an infected host to block its access to the internet?
Well, the infected host can't control a firewall, no.
Well, what would happen in a situation where there was a box on the network, a router-type machine, on the internet side of the network, before the crunch box was hooked up, such as a router between the internet connection and the crunch box? If that particular
right.
machine was
that
compromised...
That would be a crunch box to be set in a bridge mode at that point.
Well, if the crunch box was set in a bridge mode and the machine that was actually controlling the internet, the router for the particular organization, was compromised... Wouldn't it then theoretically be possible for someone to conduct a man-in-the-middle attack by emulating your website and feeding the crunch box a false set of updates?
Basically.
Yeah, even if that could possibly happen. But it would be pretty hard. Number one, when the customer connects to our box, number one, we know who they are. You know, we know who they are. And the reason why we know who they are is because they register their IP address. When the crunch box becomes activated. Usually when you we can take a crunch box and you can download it from our server, but it won't do you any good because it's gotta be registered.
So the software in the crunch box is in binary only format?
No, it's all open source. You don't really get the actual web-based CGI. And there's only a very small portion of it that's locked, and that's the authentication part of it.
Okay.
And so basically the way it works is, when we get a new customer, we issue them a key. And when they config the crunch box, it asks you for the key. They can go to the config editor of the crunch box, and they can type in the authentication key. The authentication key is key to that computer system that's running the crunch box, which means it hashes the MAC address of the NIC. It does all kinds of hashing. So it uniquely identifies it by the MAC address, by the IP address. Other unique features of that machine are used, which basically match the crunch box to that machine. and all authentication goes through that key. So it'd be really hard to break into that. You'd have to really know a lot about it. I don't even know about it. You could torture me to death and I couldn't tell you because I just don't know. Because that's not my department. See, we've got, like, right now, two people working on it. And there are certain things in it that I don't even know about. But there are other things in there that my partner don't know about. But what we do is we communicate with each other on things so that what happens is I don't really know how the key works. And there are certain things that it does that my partner doesn't know about.
So
each one of us works on a different module and are responsible for different modules.
Only users who have their IP address and MAC address and machine registered on your system will be able to download the current updates for the machine. So if I were to, like, type in the location of your tar GSIP file in my browser, it would just say no and wouldn't let me even access
it. Yeah, it wouldn't let you in. No, it wouldn't let you in. Because the key is not registered. You have to have the key registered before it lets you in. But your crunchbox is still enabled. No matter
what. Well,
it's
understandable.
Once we issued them the key, there's nothing we could do to disable the crunchbox.
Is there a reason you chose the Intel platform over a Macintosh or another platform?
Yeah, well, number one, Intel is a lot cheaper than the Macintosh. The hardware, the Intel hardware is a lot more reliable. I admit, you know, that Apple is a good system, but I really don't have very much faith in the hardware. You know, I mean, although I have had pretty good luck with my V3 laptop. There's been some people that have had a lot of problems with their iMacs and iBooks and things like that. And some of the more lower-grade Macs.
Didn't you used to work for Apple Computer?
A long, long time ago, back when there was, like, 15 employees.
Okay.
No one would know anything about it today.
I noticed on your website that Steve Wozniak is actually...
Yeah. I mean, the crunchbox itself, remember, you got to understand, the crunchbox is nothing more than a value-added thing. All we've done, really, is taken a good top-of-the-line Intel box that's reliable, server-grade quality box, and we've installed the latest stable OpenBSD on it, the latest stable stored on it, the latest stable other stuff on it.
And then just added certain commands.
We
right.
put it all together. We put a nice web-based GUI around it.
Right.
And make it so that the average Joe Schnoz that doesn't have any Unix experience at all can make good use out of it and have it not be prone to any buffer overflow attacks, network attacks, or whatever. And have all that stuff just be available from a web-based GUI, which itself is very rock stable and solid. It's got four layers of protection on that.
What are those four layers?
Well, the first layer of protection is in a normal setup. You would normally never have outside access of your crunchbox. It'd just be one machine inside your local area network. Let's say you have a network that's 192.168.0.1. That'd be your router address. Say it's a FastC network. So your crunchbox could be on 192.168.0.3. That would be the box, which could be anything. It could be a Windows machine. It could be a Mac. It could be anything. And all that box does is just access the crunchbox's attacking server, and the attacking server just simply will block all. Will not let any IP address through except 192.168.0.3. Only that IP address would allow the Apache to connect to it, which would then put you into the crunchbox GUI through Apache.
So that's the first layer of security?
That's the first layer. And the second layer, of course, is using encryption, so it's using TLS, HTTPS connection. So it's encrypted, so you can't sniff the network and figure out what's going on. The third layer is it's password protected. So in order to just activate the Crunchbox, you have to put the up to 192.168.0.1, and then it comes in and asks you for your username and password. So that's also your third layer of protection. Okay, and your fourth layer of protection is just your its ability to just not allow outside access. So these are the different layers of protection that it has. So, and it's pretty solid. We've had our demo box up there now for the longest time, and people are hacking on it all the time, and they're not able to do anything with it.
Yeah, I've actually played with the demo previous to me coming on here, and I do like the look and feel of the system. It just seems like a pretty neat way to incorporate all the tools in one decently.
Well, exactly. That's what it's designed for. It's designed primarily to just provide a very secure network with very little work involved.
Right.
It doesn't take more than 5 or 10 minutes every day to go up and check the logs, see what your network is doing, who's accessing your network, who's scanning your network. Very often what I do in my development box is I disable ping and scan. So the minute you scan my network, you're gone. You're already on the shit list. And I know you'll never get access to my crunch box. Because if you scan it, you're gone. That's it. And you're not able to get in.
Is the Crunchbox a machine that is bought? Is it leased? Is there any kind of licensing involved for the use of it?
No, you buy it. It's totally yours. Once you buy it, here's what we do. Initially, we're starting to do this now. We're getting some people that are late in paying us, which kind of sucks. So what we do is when we deliver the box, we issue our customer a 30-day key. That will enable them to use the crunch box and get it set up for the 30-day period for what they do. After 30 days, if we don't receive a payment from them, full payment from the crunch box, after the agreed-upon payment time, which would be 30 to 45 days, from the time we ship it to them until the time they pay us, they have 30 days. During that 30-day period, they can use the crunch box, get familiar with it, it's fully functional, everything like that. But at a certain agreed-upon date, if we don't receive the check in the mail by that time, the Crunchbox access expires. They can't do anything. However, it would still work at their initial setup. In other words, they can go in if they want to and use all the Unix commands and go in and use it. If they have to change it, they can't use the GUI. They're locked out of the GUI. So it's going to mean that these people are going to have to be really good OpenBSD programmers, or they're going to have to pay up.
All right. I was just going to ask, what's to stop somebody from changing the 30-day trial and disabling the cloud?
It's virtually impossible. You're never going to do it.
How so?
You're never going to do it.
It seems like every time a claim like that's made, it's kind of...
You can try to change the date, but it won't do any good. Because if you meddle with the CGIs, even though the CGIs are in Python, you're still not going to, even if you decompile it, you're still not going to, if you make any changes to the Python code, the magic number changes, and if you do that, the whole system shuts down.
Well, if it is an uncrackable system, there must have been some, very creative ways of going about doing the
protection.
So can you explain what you've done with it?
That part of it is, like you said before, I don't know that part of it.
Okay.
That part of it's out of my realm of understanding, because that part of it was done by another person.
Right.
So I personally cannot give you any information about how that's done.
Well, you shouldn't tell it to regular people
I can talk about it. I mean, suffice to say, it's not a very robust thing, but it's very effective.
I mean, it's uncrackable, you just have government contracts.
What's that?
I said if it's uncrackable, like you say, then you should have some government contracts behind you.
Well, it's the old problem with the fox guarding the hen house.
Which is another reason why I chose not to know a lot of things about the crunch box.
Right.
It's because the less I know of the crunch box, the more at ease people will feel when using it, because it's like the fox starting the hen house.
Right. But I mean, you would make more money.
I don't mind if I'm the fox. I don't mind being locked out of the hen house.
Right.
I want to be locked out of the hen house. So it's a matter of trust. It's a matter of being accepted in the industry. And there are people who still feel, I suspect, I don't know this for a fact, but there are people that have a certain amount of mistrust in what's going on with me. I mean, let's face it, you know, I'm a bad, evil guy. You know?
Do you have more than one model or tier of service?
Yeah, we've got various different models. Our low-end model is about $6,000 in price, and our high-end model is $18,000. And the difference is basically the speed of the internet. Our top-of-the-line model can handle the Ethernet traffic at bus speed, virtually at bus speed, running the full core. So it's very good. It's very good performance. We're getting full bus speed, 480 megabits per second. And that can protect a good square mile of DSL users.
Have you had a lot of takers yet?
We're selling them, but you know what we do is we sell them in spurts. We have runs. We wait until we get it. We wait until we get some orders piled up. And then what we do is during that time we negotiate with a potential client on delivery dates, and we try to work out a delivery date with them to where we match the delivery dates with several other people. So during a run we might make two or three boxes at a time.
And you said this is a three-person team, yourself and two others?
Oh, well, there's just me and one other person that's making them.
And supporting the software.
And we have one person, which is our CEO. And then we have another person, which was one of our investors, who is now our CFO, financial office.
Approximately how many units have you created thus far?
How many crunch boxes?
Yes, sir.
I really do not know the answer to that question. I really don't know.
Do you have any customers at this point?
I'm not exposed to that part of the process.
It sounds like you're really out of the loop on some of these things.
I am out of the loop on these things, and for a very good reason. What's that?
What's your position in this company?
I'm CTO, but I am in the loop on technical aspects. But as far as shipping goes, as far as how many that are being made, I can find out, but I chose not to know.
Do you have any competitors at this point? Someone selling similar products?
There are people out there selling IPS systems, yeah, but they're priced at about double what our prices are. And they're not using, you know, they're probably using Linux boxes or something, you know.
Well, I do have to commend the choice of OpenBSD for an application such as this. That is definitely the correct choice.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we've spent a lot of time evaluating various different forms of Linux, you know. I mean, we did the SUSE, we did the Red Hat, and the other versions of Linux, and we did 3BSD, and played around with that. We played around with Solaris. You know, we all just kind of took the pros and cons, but we liked OpenBSD the best because of its track record, for one.
How long in development has the crunch box been up to this point?
About 4 years now. Actually, 3 years. It's been around for 3 years, but it's been more tested in the last 6 months than any time. We're also finding new uses for it as well, for anti-spam, for instance. We're also working on spam crunchers, which is not one of my... This is where I've actually been spending most of my time on. Building an automatic spam reporting system.
Right, and that's where Snort comes in, right?
Well, no, Snort doesn't come in that respect. We're not using Snort for that.
Mm-hmm.
But what, the way it works is we've got a very good patented way of filtering spam.
Right.
250,000 spam messages over the last 6 months. And out of 250,000, none of them had any false negatives in it.
No false negatives, but what's your rate of report?
Well, the rate of report is a question. Before it was very slow because we were doing a whois for each and every time we reported to extract email addresses out of the whois output, and that took a lot of time. So what we've done now is we're building up a new database, and we're doing the whois now separately, and we're building a large database of the whois for every single CIDR on the internet. We get that information from the Looking Glass server. So we've got all of the net blocks of every single IP address on the internet. And then we do the whois for each one of those net blocks. We get the reporting address. We put that into a large file, and we manually edit out the ones that are, you know, the ones that are important to us. Like, for instance, we will edit out something like info, and we'll keep like abuse@whatever.com.
So do you go ahead and you blacklist some of the IPs that are sending spam?
Well, what we do, first of all, we have to get all of the reporting addresses. And then when we get the spam message coming in for every message in the inbox, we extract the IP address from the message. And that's the IP address of the last gateway the message came before it came to us, which usually is the infected host. So it might say something like yada, 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 sfo.spk.comcast.net. And then so that would then get extracted into abuse@comcast.net. So therefore, that mail came from comcast.net. Then we take that spam message and we send it in its entirety with a small paragraph in whatever language the ISP happen to be in. So if it's in China, it'll actually be sent in Chinese. If it's in Russia, it'll be sent in Russian. Actually, in fact, I'm looking for anybody that knows how to translate Korean into English and English into Korean, because I don't have Korean yet. I've got every other language. I've got Arabic, I've got some various different versions of Farsi, and I've got all the common European languages.
Does the paragraph that's included with the abuse email, does that say
The abuse is basically a small little intro paragraph stating the fact that this is an automatic spam report. This is the message that came to us through your network, probably due in part to one of your customers being infected with a virus.
Okay.
I respectfully request you contact this individual immediately and have them clean their system out, yada, yada, yada. And we do this in whatever language the PIC happens to be in. We've got the language code in the database. So the IP address is an IP address that comes from France. Then it's going to go to the French language template. And you've got the different templates all in a single directory. And the language is just the key into the file. So it's basically English.tmp.txt, for instance, would be the English template. And so that would match to that file. It'd open up that file, automatically send that message in that language.
Now,
when it sends a message, it doesn't do it through our gateway. It actually goes to the gateway of what we're connecting to. So when we connect to Comcast and send it to abuse@comcast.net, we actually establish an SMTP connection directly to Comcast. We don't actually establish an SMTP connection through our own gateway.
What happens if relaying is not allowed with that gateway?
Well, that's That's one of the reasons why we do it that way.
Okay.
It's because we talk directly to the endpoint that way. So we're not relaying at all.
Good method. Now, is the spam crunch?
Another thing that it does too is that if for whatever reason that abuse email is bad, okay, we don't have to wait for the bounce. We know it immediately. And
so after the reporting is done, on those IP addresses that it couldn't report to, they're still left in on the display page, and there might be four or five of them that have it, that for whatever reason you couldn't report them, either because the abuse mail server was down, or it could be that maybe you weren't able to connect to their mail server, or for whatever reason that abuse mail didn't get set. So it just sits there, and then the next time we send it, we try it again. We can go back to these individually and manually test them, find out why they didn't get sent through. And usually it's in the case of the abuse mail system being, instead of Comcast.net, it might be Comcast.com. And the who is says Comcast.net, but they've all of a sudden changed their email address to Comcast.com. I'm just giving this as an example. You see what I mean? Because sometimes the ISP's abuse email will often change. If it does, it's a flag that lets me know immediately. Another nice thing that it does, too, which is really cool, is that it keeps track of all the ones that it reports. And every two weeks, it generates a report on the most spammy IP address that it finds. It sorts them by the most spammy IP address. So the IP address where the most spam is reported at the very beginning, at the very top.
And I discovered an interesting thing. There was one IP address that 156 spam messages came from that. All the other IP addresses, about eight or so, came from each one. So the average amount of spam that's sent from an infected host is eight spam binges. It's about eight before the ISP shuts them down. And it takes about 2 weeks before them to do that.
Now, is your spam cruncher product going to be a component of the crunch box or a standalone product that's separate?
Well, right now what we're doing is we're contemplating and making an online service, having a very short list of online members that are using it and beta testing it. And we're basically going to be picking the cream of the crop spam fighters. We're going to give them free access to it for a period of time for them to try it out and give us feedback on it. Then at that point, we'll decide whether or not we want to make this an online service and make it available to more people, or whether we want to make it a software product, or whether we want to integrate it into CrunchBox users. We still need more time in order to hone down the user interface to it, to make it easy to use. We've got some performance issues on the classifier that we need to iron out. It's relatively slow right now. It can only classify 25 messages per minute. And if you've got about 1,000 spam messages, that could take about 35 or 40 minutes for it to go through the 1,000 spam messages, to classify them and pull out the non-spam, the ones that I'm interested in. But it's also running on a slow Toshiba box. But if we run this on a top-of-the-line Intel box, we're going to get five times the speed. So we're going to probably get 150, maybe 175 messages per minute, which will be a lot better. So we're still dealing with performance issues. Right now, it's just a single user using it. And even with a single user using it, we're having some performance issues.
Well, with the CrunchBox, it sounds like you have a product that really hasn't been quite perfected yet.
Well, the CrunchBox itself has been very well perfected.
No, that's not what I meant. The way I was explaining it was you have come up with a product, and you are doing it in such a way, something that other people haven't perfected yet. Something that you managed to do that other people have dabbled with but have never come anywhere close to the level of progress that you have.
I'm sure there are other people doing the same thing. I'd be really surprised if we're the only ones doing it.
I've got a little issue with the French cluster. I'm a latecomer to the conference. It's majestic. What's going to stop a person from, if they do gain access to multi-layers of your security that you were talking about before, of war dialing and or running programs of that sort? Do you have any kind of countermeasures to help prevent that, any kind of drop-offs or anything?
something, okay, the access to the box itself, in other words, the code that's running on the box itself, is very tightly contained within the box. For instance, there's no user account on the OpenBSD system. However, the programs that are running under the web are running not as root, but as user www. But at the same time, there's root-level stuff that needs to be taken place from the web-based GUI. But that's pretty much very well contained.
So there is no remote access to that machine via Secure Shell or other means?
Normally not. However, in our demo Crunchbox, we deliberately allow remote access to it for the sole purpose because we want other people to try it out, like you people that have played with it. In that case, our demo box, yes, set up remote access, but under normal circumstances, on almost all of our production networks that we have Crunchboxes on, almost all of these networks have no remote access to the Crunchbox at all to their network. The control of the Crunchbox and the firewall system is controlled from within a machine within the local area network that has been designated as what they call the admin machine, which is a single IP address on a single machine located in a secure physical place in the company. And only that machine has access to the web-based GUI.
But even that machine doesn't have access to Secure Shell?
No, it does not.
Okay.
Only the console has access to a root-level shell.
So basically...
You could set up the rules in the Crunchbox to allow SSH access, but you don't really have to, is what I'm saying.
So it's secure by default?
Only the console, which is a physical keyboard and monitor connected to the actual physical box, is the only shell you get to the Crunchbox normally. But you could, if you wanted to, very, very easily, okay, allow any of the machines. You can designate any of those machines in your office to be have SSH access if that's what you want. In other words, if I want to, I can say, I can say I want 192.168.0.10 to have SSH port 22 access to the Crunchbox. And of course, I can set the firewall up to that. But only that machine would be the one to get SSH access to the box.
Very nice.
Because that's just a matter of just programming your packet filter rules. They're very, very well commented in the Crunchbox. So when you get the Crunchbox, we initially set up the firewall to the customer themselves, show them how to use it, and we give them a certain period of training free. We support it for a year.
Do you charge for your updates?
Depends on the update. Large updates, yes, we do charge for them, and lower level intermediate updates, and of course, emergency security patch updates, no, we don't charge for those. And whenever they want to update the system, all they have to do is go to the console of the Crunchbox, log in the root, and type update, and that's all they have to do.
Is there a way to automate that?
What's that?
Can you automate that?
It's already automated. When you do update, it's going to do whatever it has to do to update the Crunchbox.
Right, but is doing the update command, can that be automated, or you just write a script to do it?
In other words,
the update is a script that runs on that box that we provide the user. So all we have to do is there's an update script, and there are times when sometimes we might have to change that update script. Normally we don't. And that update script is nothing more than a script that runs and updates all the software.
I believe the question he was asking, though, is can you program that update script to run on a regular basis all by itself?
To run on a regular basis?
Let's say you wanted to program your Crunchbox to do an upgrade update once a month. Would that be possible through the configuration?
You could do that, but normally the way we do it, we would just simply notify the user when an update is available, and at any time after they get the notification, it would be up to them to do the update. We don't push an update on the customer. We don't have access to the customer's Crunchbox. Again, it's the fox in the henhouse syndrome. usually the customer has to instigate the update. We can't update it for them. The customer can only do that.
Well, and why do you think it would be a bad idea to program your crunch box by default to automatically update every other month or so?
Because our crunch box would then have to have access to the customer's crunch box, and the customer's crunch box is normally not accessible.
Well, what if you program
for the very reason you don't want it to be accessible?
Well, can't you make it automatically run that script, or is that script interactive?
We could, but it's not practical to do that, because usually when we do updates, we usually do updates once every 3 months.
Oh, I understand now.
It's not necessary for us to do updates every week or whatever. But the updates for the snort rules can be done through a cron job at the customer's discretion as often as they want. That they can do at any... That is just done automatically. And it goes to the snort website, pulls off all the snort rules that come from the snort website, then it goes to the Shop IP website, pulls off all the Shop IP web rules, and then it goes to the local rule set that the Crunchbox owner may have wanted to put in there that is local to that Crunchbox. These rules are put in layers. You know, we've got the root level layer, which is all the snort rules. You get everything. You got the entire snort library of all the rules. And they can go in there and pick which ones they want.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get the ones from Arachnic or whatever Arachnic, whatever the. You know, there's two or three other websites that've got other snort rules. We get them from those as well.
Alright.
And then the customer has their own rule set. We can't change that rule set.
Right.
That's up to the customer to do.
So that's just user defined.
Well, yeah, each customer will have their own rule set.
Right.
Because they might have some special things that are only applicable to their net. At the same time, there's the virus rule sets, which are on our local Shop IP website,
mm-hmm.
You know, that our customers get. And then we make it only available to our customers. And then, of course, the new ones we're going to start putting in, and those are going to be the protocols,
right.
The virus protocols. And once these protocols start getting flying to the network, we're going to block those as well. So there go all the spam trojans. Spammers are going to lose all their spam trojans.
Right.
We just have to get the ISPs to use.
Well, the show's been going about an hour. Do you guys want to wrap it up, or do you want to keep going?
I'm pretty much getting close to the end of this. I can't think of anything else. If you guys got any specific questions, I'll be able to answer those. But the point I'm trying to make is this. Is that there's a major problem out there. There's close to 500,000 infected machines out there that are being controlled by spammers and God knows who else.
Right.
The access to these machines being bought and sold on the black market at a very high price. There's a lot of talent in writing these viruses that are out there.
Right.
And some of this talent is very good, and this is very high-paid talent, and there's a lot of money available to pay these programmers to write these viruses. And with the job situation these days, and everything is outsourced, there's a huge glut of programmers out there in the market right now that are available to do this kind of work.
Right.
And if you were 5 months late in mortgage payments, and you're about ready to have a foreclosure brought against your house, and all of a sudden a spammer comes to you and offers you $35,000 to write a virus, would you do it? More than likely, you know, some people would. I'm sure that you being an ethical person might not, but there are people out there that are hungry enough for that kind of cash to write this stuff.
Right. But I think if somebody has that much skill to write viruses like that,
most of these viruses these days are being written by spam gangs and Eastern European hackers, which are really damn good.
Right.
I mean, these guys are very clever. And it's not uncommon for spam gangs to hire these virus writers and spread the viruses out. The spammers would be spreading the viruses out, and the virus writers wouldn't have that kind of penetration like a spammer would.
Right.
A spammer can get this thing out to 150 to 200 million people in one night, you know. And how, and out of that many mails, how many are going to be opening up that attachment? You know?
Right.
So, and once that virus gets released, now the control of those viruses are being controlled by a very small handful of people. And now the control of these viruses can now be bought and sold on the black market.
Right.
Say, hey, I've got passwords to 50,000 infected hosts. Here they are.
How much would something like that sell for in the black market?
Yeah.
Probably a lot of money. I mean, you got to figure that with all these spam proxies being shut down now, as ISPs are becoming more less and less spam friendly or spammer friendly.
Because we are clear about that.
Point now where the only really major source of spam is coming from infected hosts, and if you shut those down, you probably shut down about 60-80% of the spam that comes out right now.
That's not bad.
So you can cut down a lot of spam if you just, you know, report your spam. Sign up to SpamCop. It's free. Get on SpamCop and start sending your reports in. Because the spam you get is just coming from an infected host. And if you can do your part in shutting those down, and one less infected host means one less spam source. Yeah. I mean, I've done some analysis. I found out there is about, for every single infected IP address, it sends out 8 copies of spam to me and me alone.
Right.
In a 3-week period. But then, it'll of course send out 8 copies of spam to 250 million other people.
Right.
Well, these other IP addresses will be doing those work. What I'm saying, though, is that it takes about 3 weeks for these IPs to be shut down, but new ones are coming up all the time. So what I'm getting is a progressive change of these IP addresses. So I can also map out which ones are leaked IP addresses from DHCP and which ones are not. Because even though that spam could be coming from that IP address, someone else could leak that IP address a couple days later and get infected, and that IP address can be sending spam again.
Right.
This is why it's important to report it all the time. So what the ISP does is when the ISP gets, you know, 20 or 30 reports on a single IP address, they say, oh, this guy's infected.
Right.
There was one time when I got, like I said, 156 spams from this one IP address. Turns out that IP address belonged to a very small mom-and-pop operation, which was a co-location facility. It turned out to be one of the church's computer systems to a church group got compromised by a hacker, and it was being used as a mail gateway to send spam. And it wasn't connected to an ISP. It was connected to the school's network, which had their services on an IP address that belonged to some industrial IP bank, you know, that was available for customers and not for, like, consumers.
Was it a hacker, or was it just somebody that opened up an attachment?
It was somebody in the church that opened up an attachment that got the thing infected.
Well, that's not nice.
And but I found out who it was, and I contacted them, and I let them know. I said, hey, look, your machine is infected. Oh, thank you very much. And the next day, it was gone. Right. I never got any more spam from them.
Nice.
See, so this is what the spam crunchers does. It gives a report on all the spam that it got. It categorizes and sorts everything by IP address. It does a lot of analysis work and analysis type stuff that you normally don't get anywhere else.
Wow.
You can also plot graphs. You can also plot a neighborhood in real time and get where all the spam comes from. It plots the first octet against the second octet of an IP address.
Alright.
So you get a graphic neighborhood graphic pattern of where it all comes from visually.
Alright.
And
And we're also putting in geographical coordinates system into the database. We're adding another field into the database, the IP address, to put geographical coordinates in there so that we can also plot it on a map.
Right. And then hopefully just shut down those areas.
Well, the user who uses the Spam Cruncher service will just be able to bring this thing up on their web browser and look at it in real time. Because this is some of the stuff that we're going to have. Other cool features, too, is that I don't know whether you got any mail messages from me, but you notice that my return address is crunch followed with a number @shopip.com.
Mm-hmm.
You notice that?
Yes.
In the email message that I sent you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, guess what? If that email address starts showing up in spam, I'll know exactly where that email address came from.
Right.
You.
Nice. So that would just mean that that our computers would have been affected and then inadvertently sent out through you. Correct?
Well, no, actually what happened was there was one time that we reported the spam to a United Arab Republic internet service provider from the UAE. Now, all of a sudden, I started getting spam from the UAE coming from an IP address.
Right.
I mean, coming from an email address that's coming from one of those ones that I sent an email to.
Right.
I went to the database and tracked it down to an abuse to a United Arab Republic system, and that was how that... So it was that person who had my email address, but somehow that spam message was attached to that email address, got sent to me, but it wasn't a spam message, it was a copy of a virus.
Right. Jeez.
And how did that guy in the United Arab Republic get an email address that was only sent to them and only used for them to communicate with me? How did I get a virus coming from that, unless it came from that?
Right.
Chances of that happening randomly is 20,000 to 1 or 99,000 to 1.
Right, or it could have just been like an address book virus.
Well, who knows?
Yeah.
I sent them an email message letting them know that, and it, you know, but even that email message didn't come from them. That virus didn't actually come from the UAE system.
Right.
It came from an infected host inside the USA. It came from like a Comcast user, the virus.
Right.
But the email address that it was addressed to was my email address, but that email address had that unique number on it.
Yeah.
Right. I looked up that unique number, and guess what? That number came from an email address that I had sent. Because remember, that unique number will only come from me if I send them a message.
Right.
So if I use Spam Cruncher to send anybody a message, that anybody is going to get put into my address list automatically.
Right.
See? And if I get an email from anyone else but that person, then I know who that person is.
Right.
Which is kind of neat, because now I can go out there and I can actually sign up for shit on the web, you know, using one of those special addresses.
Right.
And if I ever get any spam, I'll know that company or organization abused my trust. And I've actually busted 3 spammers that do that. That did that so far.
Right.
In fact, I tracked them down. I tracked it down to a Russian spam gang.
Wow.
Sending me porn.
Yeah, Russians are pretty
site, and the porn sites were themselves infected hosts.
Right. As most of them are.
If you go to a URL in a spam message and click on the URL, the domain of that URL will be bogus information, but that domain will reference another IP address, and if you do the reverse
DNS at that IP address, that DNS IP address would be something like from Comcast or something.
Right. So you mean not only do the spammers use compromised systems to send their email, but the actual...
They are also offering bulletproof hosting that they will host your website on those compromised machines.
Wow, so everything about spam was totally 100% illegal.
And it's totally untraceable.
Right.
It is virtually untraceable.
So the only thing you can do is just try to block it.
That's right.
Huh. Interesting.
That's right. And it's working. I mean, it works on a small scale.
Yeah.
Will it work on a big scale? I don't know unless I try it. Unless I can find an ISP that's big enough that wants to set up a network like this. It's not that hard to set up. It's better connecting the box up to the network, making, you know, and then having it send a through an authenticated channel to a VPN to the internet service provider's firewall. So it would send a command to the firewall to block that port number. However, that sends command of the firewall is up to the ISP and their security policy and on who they let control their firewall. But if they need to have that installed in an area, that will allow that to happen. Because the only way that you're going to block this is if you proactively deal with it in a preventive way. And how do you do that? Is when you detect it 20 milliseconds later, the connection is broken. And when the connection is broken, then the communication stops and the virus is totally useless.
Right.
So it cannot send any spam anymore. It's dead.
I think you have a really good system going for you.
Yeah, and I need people like you to go out there and let other people know about it.
Oh, we do.
Do you have a reseller program?
What's that?
Do you have a reseller or affiliation program?
Not yet. We're still trying to, you know, feel our way into that.
Well, I run a security website, and if you ever get involved in an affiliation or reseller program, let me know. I might be able to bring some people in.
Well, what is your email address? Hang on a minute.
My email address is the word hairball, which is
what?
Hairball, HairBall.
Hang on. Okay.
At USA.com.
And your name?
My name is, you know what, just give me an email, I'll give you all my docs.
Okay, alright. Okay, hang on a minute.
Okay,
yeah, I'll send you some information. You can send me the URL to your website.
Okay.
And, yeah, I mean, I'm always interested in working with people on this. You know, right now I'd like to get this thing tested on a larger scale, on a larger network, either on a large corporate network or on a consumer DSL cable modem system, like at one of the border routers. What?
You're looking to get yours at a point of presence somewhere where there's a.
Yeah, I just needed to sit on a border router. Is all I need to do is sit on a border router. And sniff the network. Remember, it works in passive mode. There's no going through it or anything.
If you want to sniff a network, mine's the one to sniff, because I got lots of activity going through my stuff.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
I run a free shell
well,
project.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. You buy me the hardware.
Ah.
You buy the hardware. I can't do it. I don't have any money. You buy the hardware. You send us the hardware, we will install the Crunchbox system on there, we'll ship it to you, we'll help you get it set up. Remember this, you're going to also need to set up a honey net as well, a honeypot, because you're going to have to analyze the virus.
Oh, if you're looking for hacker activity, we got plenty already, we don't send a body pot.
Yeah.
Well, actually, we're looking for a place to put a honeypot on. In fact,
you don't need a honeypot. Trust me on that one. I'll go to my website and you'll understand.
Well, yeah, you do need a honeypot because you need to isolate the virus to get the protocol for the virus.
I understand what you mean now.
But you can't
take a customer's machine and call that a honeypot. That's illegal.
Right.
Because in order for the honeypot, in order for me to sniff the honeypot and monitor traffic on that honeypot to do it legally, it's got to be my machine or a machine that's on your network. There's nothing wrong with you putting a machine on your network calling it a honeypot. You can monitor that machine and put a sniffer on that machine all you want, legally. It's your machine.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
But you can't be going putting a sniffer on your customer's machine. I mean, you know, that's like wiretapping.
When you put it like that, I totally understand it.
Right.
You know, but if it's my machine on my network, on a subnet that I control, yeah, I have every right to put a sniffer on that network. It's just like you connecting, it's like you having your own LAN at home on your 192.168 IP box, right? And you put a sniffer on there, you're not breaking the law because it's your home network. You can do whatever you want to with it. You can tap it and you can monitor traffic on it or do what you want to do. It's your network. But you can't go into a company or go into an internet cafe and go sniffing the network there because you're tapping someone else's system.
Oh, I understand.
And, you know, so the thing is, and this is one of the reasons why I like it so much, is because when properly deployed, and I say properly deployed, okay, you can do this without violating anybody's privacy.
Right.
Which is really important. So to an ISP, the ISP does not have to monitor the customer's actions. All the ISP has to do is act on the incident reports and implement this system that I proposed in the white paper.
Right.
Have you sold any crunch boxes to any Fortune 500 or other major businesses?
I really don't know. I really don't know. It's just that I don't, because like I said, that's not my area. See, we're in separate places. Like our CEO is in Modesto, I'm in Stockton. Our company corporate offices are in Patterson.
What state are you in?
California.
I was under the impression you lived in Florida.
No.
I don't know where I heard that at.
Well, I was in Florida at one time, but that was a long time ago.
Where can the listeners get a copy of your white paper at? And more information?
It'll be on shopid.com. Just look for a link. It'll be on the homepage when it's up there. It's not up there yet. Like I said,
Don't
take what I've sent you and publish that.
Okay.
The reason why is that is a draft.
Right.
That's a draft. And the only reason why I sent it to you is for one reason only, to see familiar with what I'm going to be talking about.
Right.
Okay.
Just want to make that clear. The reason why I don't want you to sell it is because it needs to be proofread.
Right. Edited.
There's lots of spelling mistakes. It's probably grammatically incorrect. There's lots of things in there that need to be corrected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm waiting for other people to give me feedback on that.
Right. That's perfect.
Including you guys.
Right.
So if you see anything in there like typos or misspellings, anything that looks like it's written poorly, let me know, please, because I want to fix it.
Right. That's perfectly understandable.
Yeah, I need, because if this thing is going to be published, it's got to be written right. I'm not much of a writer, so.
Right.
So, you know, I got to have time to have it gone over with a professional proofreader, and I just need time to do that.
Right.
So as soon as it's done, I'm going to put a link to it on my website. You'll be able to look at it both in HTML form. I'll also be able to download it in a PDF or in a .doc file.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a PDF. Put it in as a PDF and as a link, so you'll be able to scroll up and just read it up and read it from your browser.
Alright. Well, is there anything you'd like to promote?
The only thing right now I want to promote is Crunchbox and get people to understand and, you know, what it does. And I want to try to get this idea promoted out there so people can go out and develop this system, the
I have.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's important.
Right. Oh, it definitely is. I mean, it sounds like you got a pretty much uncrackable box.
Honestly,
to be honest with you, I mean, if the ratio for not being able to crack your box is as it is what you say, then I would definitely shop around for, like, government contracts, you know.
You know what?
Because you would pay a lot of money for that.
You need a GSA license.
Right.
And it needs to be certified.
Yeah.
The certification process is $35,000.
Right.
None of us have that kind of money.
Right.
Number two is the GSA license itself. To get the GSA license to sell anything to the government,
mm-hmm.
it's pretty much an impossibility unless you're a really, really big corporation like Aerojet and NASA and all these big companies, you know, important Diacol and all that, whatever these big corporate companies that do things to the government, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those guys have GSA licenses. You have to have a GSA license before you can sell to the government.
Right.
And to get a GSA license requires a lot more than resources that we could ever possibly come up with.
Right. Well, you at least have it patented, don't you?
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Oh, of course. We've got quite a few of the aspects patented, for sure.
Right. That's good.
Well, we've got it pending anyway. I mean, we filed it. We're just waiting for approval.
Right. That's good.
Alright. So most of the stuff that we've got is really all common technology. We're just applying it in a different way.
Right.